Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. We got a busy show today, continuing our discussion with gubernatorial candidates as we did yesterday with Matt Dunn and Peter Galbraith. We'll talk today with Sue Minter, who will be in studio. She's a Democratic candidate for governor. And then tomorrow, we'll speak with Phil Scott and Bruce Lissman. Also on the program today, Elizabeth Hewitt, reporter from Vermont Digger. She'll be in studio with us. And we'll talk about a court case in Bennington County. There was a ruling against a revenge porn case, and we'll speak to her about this case and about the ramifications of this ruling. It's being appealed to the Supreme Court. But first, I wanted to take about 20 or 30 minutes here to just talk about something we started yesterday and really didn't have a lot of time to explore, and that is, what is Donald Trump thinking? Is he really trying to lose the election? Give us a call. Be interested in your opinion at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Why in the world, as we talked yesterday, why in the world would you ever go after the parents of a dead soldier? A war hero at that. You know, and then try to say that your sacrifice is equivalent to that those parents' sacrifice. There is no equivalency there. Don't even try to make an equivalency there, especially when your equivalency is that you created jobs, started businesses. Okay, I get that. But you didn't lose a child. You know, Hillary didn't go after this setup. Hillary Clinton was hit in the Republican National Convention by Patricia Smith. And Patricia Smith talked about her son who was killed in Benghazi, Sean Smith, a communications person working for the State Department. He was killed with the ambassador of Libya during the time in Benghazi at the diplomatic compound. But she didn't go after Patricia Smith, and that was smart because you can never go after the mother, the parents of a dead child that was in a combat situation. And it isn't the first time that Donald Trump has gone after somebody on a war record or a war hero. He went after John McCain because John McCain was a POW. And according to Donald Trump, he likes people who weren't caught rather than those people that were caught. That was an enormous insult to people who are fighting out there on the front lines. And yesterday, he talked about his Purple Heart that some veteran gave him. And the veteran has every right to give Donald Trump a Purple Heart. But what he should have said was that I am honored that this person gave me this. I do not deserve this. And I'm going to give it back to this individual, but I'm honored for what it represents. Instead, he says, look at what I got, and this is the easier way to get it. You know how demeaning that is to veterans? So my question right out of the blocks this morning, is Donald Trump trying to lose this election? If you're a conspiracy theorist out there and thinking that this is all a setup for Hillary Clinton, boy, Donald Trump is giving you a lot of ammunition in order to believe that. I don't happen to believe in the conspiracy theory, but boy, You've got a lot of ammunition if you're a conspiracy theorist thinking that Donald Trump is trying to lose this election. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. What's Donald Trump thinking? Is he trying to lose the election? You know, this is a guy, let's face it, I mean, he's gone after the parents of a war hero. He's gone after John McCain. The Purple Heart incident yesterday was just unbelievable. And this is a guy who's never served. Now, I understand other presidents, other presidential candidates haven't served. And you don't need to be in the military to serve. But you got to respect the military if you're going to be president of the United States. And I don't know. I mean, Donald Trump was in the nightclubs when Vietnam was going around, and he didn't even have the guts to protest the war. So my question today is, Donald Trump trying to lose the election? 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Look, you know, he's out there right now, Donald Trump, saying the election is rigged. But the election isn't rigged right now. What's the problem is the Republicans have nominated somebody who is a very ill-prepared candidate. Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Edward in Waterbury Center. Edward, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hello, good morning. You know, Donald Trump, of course, is unfit to be the president of this country. But I think what's happened in this primary election series is the American public has learned that there's really very little democracy left. A lot of analysts have proven that Bernie Sanders actually would have won the nomination if it weren't for Hillary's vote rigging and efforts by the DNC to quash a third party attempting to obtain the Democratic nomination. And even the current President Obama doesn't apply the will of the American people. I mean, at the very least, we asked for labeling of our food, which was one of his campaign promises. We can't even have that. A few simple words on packaging, and we can't have that. The Grocery Manufacturers Association and Monsanto quashed it because originally they didn't want a label. It's too much trouble. But it's not too much trouble to put a QR code on it, which is vastly more complicated than a couple of words. Mm-hmm. We can't even have that as a democracy. I think what happens now, we really need to elect a third-party candidate, which, if nothing else, would prove whether or not we can elect a president that we want and that isn't chosen by the powers that be.
Edward, very, very good phone call. Thank you very much for calling in. You know, Edward makes a good point. And perhaps Trump can still win because Hillary Clinton is so weak. But it's time for Republicans to speak up. Trump isn't loyal to Republicans. He hasn't been. So why should Republicans be loyal to him? He won't endorse Republicans. He won't endorse Paul Ryan. He won't endorse John McCain. He rails against the party leadership. If you don't believe in the Republican Party, and up until a few years ago, Donald Trump was a Democrat, then don't run in the party. Run someplace else. He doesn't espouse conservative values. He'll raise taxes. He'll force companies back to the United States, according to his campaign promises, that are now overseas. He's not a fair trader. So you conservatives, what do you see in him? Military and veterans, I get it. You're frustrated with the current Obama administration. Edward is frustrated with the current Obama administration for another reason. And you're frustrated with Hillary Clinton. You know, to Benghazi, to many people that haven't served in the military, that may not be of an interest to you. But to many veterans, to many active military personnel, it was a failure to have their backs when they needed help. When Americans needed help in faraway places and under attack.
Trump insults veterans every day, whether it's POWs, whether it's the Purple Heart, whether it's other dead soldiers or parents of dead soldiers. He says he's for veterans, but he doesn't have an understanding of what it means to serve. You know, I don't often agree with President Obama, but I agree that it's time for Republicans to stand up and stop supporting Trump. I get that people are upset. I get that. I'm upset with the political system as well. I know that people believe that political and financial and business leaders let them down in the crash of 2008. And by the way, they're right. People were greedy. Politicians weren't paying attention to what was going on. They have every right to be angry. But is this what you want? A guy whose sole strategy is to insult his way to the presidency? Let's go back to the phone lines. Fred from Newberry, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hey, I got a question and a theory, if you can bear with me.
Yeah, you got to make it quick. Our phone lines are wrapped up here.
Oh, okay. So anyways, Trump's going to withdraw from the race on the 25th of October. So he's going to be out. Don't vote for me. And my theory is you can't print new ballots, and I don't think you can vote for a vice president. You have to vote for a president, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Republican Party could, at that point, be too late. But
that's right. It would be too late. That's what I'm saying. So we're going to make it. He's going to make it impossible for the Republicans to get back into the race because it's going to be too late. You can't vote. You can't vote for a Republican. He's going to withdraw. Hillary wins. She's going to be the new queen.
Thanks, Fred. Fred, you've thought this conspiracy theory out quite well, actually. Rama from Williamstown. Rama, you're on open mic.
Correction and a comment here. Everybody isn't frustrated with Obama so much as there are small parts of Obama's administration that have frustrated me, but I've been really just frustrated with the Republicans at the national level that have done everything to be as obstructionist to any compromise policies as possible. And therein, though, is why you have Donald Trump as the Republican presidential candidate, is because this is just a natural outgrowth of what has been going on with the Republicans. And basically, Newt Gingrich kicked it off, although he at least was willing to negotiate and work together to get things accomplished. But, you know, this whole process in the Republican Party about becoming more and more obstinate as time goes on, more absolutist, more that everybody is out to get us and everybody but us are a bunch of evil so-and-sos, you know. It's no accident that the party that brought us Sarah Palin as a vice presidential candidate 8 years ago is now trying to bring us the son of Sarah Palin as a presidential candidate now.
Rama, I don't buy your argument because I think the whole damn system is broken. Both Democrats are obstinate. Both Republicans are Republicans. Hold on for a minute. Republicans are obstinate when they are in power. It doesn't matter if it's Democrats or Republicans. They're both equally to blame in this system. So you can talk about Republicans and they're in power now and they're being obstinate. Maybe I agree with you. But Democrats have done the exact same thing when they've been in power.
Absolutely not. The Democrats have never tried to shut our government down because they weren't getting their way. Democrats have always been irritating progressives because they are prone to compromise with Republicans and what they're considered.
We're going to disagree on this, Rama.
Well, I'm right, so I'll talk to you later.
See you later. Rama, thank you for your phone call. Look, Republicans out there, here's the question for you. What will the party look like after Trump is done with it? Trump's not loyal to Republicans or its party. It's about him. Then why should Republicans be loyal to him? Look, you already know my position. I'm not going to vote for Trump. So the question is, will you and why? And the other question is Trump trying to lose this election. Let's go to John in Burlington. John, you're on open mic.
Good morning, Mike. You know, you talk about voters being frustrated. I'm frustrated with the way you present your agendas from day to day from the Republican perspective. The question today should be, is Donald Trump fit to be president in terms of temperament, experience, you name it? Instead, you do a great job of explaining why Democrats are frustrated. You can just keep the Republican slant and try to be a little bit more open-minded and even-minded, please.
John, hold on here. Don't go away here. What? John's gone away. Why am I holding a Republican slant? I just said I'm not going to support Donald Trump, and I'm urging other Republicans not to support him as well. John, how in the world is that a Republican slant? Tell me. Call me back. Tell me that. Explain it to me how that's a Republican slant. Because I want to know. I really want to know, John. Call me back. Let's go to Rick in Adamont. Rick, you're on open mic.
Yeah, let me turn off my tractor here for a minute. Rama's absolutely right. And things are broken. And it is really the Republican plot. Right from when Obama was being inaugurated, they were plotting in the back rooms on how to sabotage his administration. So he wouldn't be able to get much of anything done. And this goes back to, I don't know if you're familiar or heard of the Lewis Powell memo, and from 1971, in which he spelled out to the conservatives, this is what we need to do to take back, to take control of the government and basically run it into the ground. And that is by taking over the media, which they have done, and taking over education, which they have done to a large degree, and taking over the state legislatures by hook or by crook, one way or another. And that's happened to a large degree, too. And this has all been going on, and, funded by the Koch brothers and the 400 billionaires who get together every so often to continue this takeover and basically privatize everything from, fire departments to schools to you name it. Private free enterprise is one thing, but to take over, public services and all that is really not... It's bringing about the destruction of this country.
Thanks, Rick, for your phone call. I appreciate it. Remember, there was a James Carville memo as well after Bush was so high. This is George W. Bush was so high in the polls after 9/11 that basically said we have to go after this guy. So both sides do this. Bernie Sanders is right. The political system is broken. Where it is wrong is that we are looking at a candidate in Donald Trump to fix it. And I just don't believe that's the fix. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in our WDEV studio Sue Minter, Democratic candidate for governor. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning, Mike. Great to be here.
Well, thank you. Let's get right into it. We've got about 30 minutes, so let's get right into it. Matt Dunn says you got a lot of splaining to do regarding the signing of an airport management contract with Ariel Quiroz. Do you?
You know, what I can say is that Matt Dunn is intentionally misleading the public by trying to smear my name. Matt knows that this project is not an EB-5 project. Matt knows that this is a contract that is a standard contract that we use in all of our airports. And I am surprised and disappointed that Matt is really turning to what I consider Washington-style tactics to smear my name.
One of the things, though, that I'm curious about, that this contract was signed while investigations were going on with Ariel Quiroz. Did you know that there was an investigation going on, and did that give you any pause?
Well, I had no idea there was an investigation going on. Investigations, as you know, Mike, are confidential. These are not information for the public. And it is obvious to me that this is a deliberate attempt to undermine my integrity. And I am very surprised by it. You know, I don't think Vermonters are really looking for those kinds of Washington-style tactics. I think they're looking for someone with integrity, honesty, and someone they can count on.
He asked some questions in a letter to you. Do you plan on answering them?
You know, Anne Galloway of Vermont Digger has investigated his allegations. And in yesterday's Digger, it was confirmed that she saw no improprieties of this contract. And I think for me, I am focused on working on the real issues that matter to Vermonters. You know, we have economic challenges. Too many Vermonters struggling in this economy just to make ends meet. I know that 43% of women working full-time in Vermont still can't make ends meet. Those are the issues that I want to work on, I want to talk on.
We're going to talk about those issues in just a moment. Do you support the EB-5 program?
You know, the EB-5 program, I will tell you, under my watch, is going to have to be given a second look. We have to evaluate whether we can, in fact, do our due diligence in regulating. Obviously, we have to understand the allegations being made, but it will come under deep scrutiny under the Minter administration.
Peter Galbraith yesterday equated your position on wind as destroying our ridge lines. What is your position on wind?
Well, I'm a strong supporter of renewable energy, and I am focused on continuing to have Vermont lead our energy transformation. It is critical. I know that climate change is not just real, it is here. Of course, we knew that after Irene, and then I subsequently had the opportunity to serve on President Obama's White House Climate Task Force, worked with leaders across this country dealing with the effects of climate change, drought in California, fire in Colorado. So I believe strongly that we need to use all of our efforts, including well-sited wind, to address what I think is the greatest threat to our generation, our planet.
The contention among this wind debate that's going on seems to be the involvement of local government. How is local government involved in this? Do they have certain rights in terms of opposition to wind? Matt Dunn's position is that if there is a referendum and local government doesn't want wind there, then he'll take the full force of the position of governor in order to make sure that wind isn't developed in that community. Peter Galbraith says wind shouldn't be on our ridgelines at all. How do you define that input at the local level, both in terms of citizens and local government?
Well, Mike, you may know that I am a planner. I have a professional planner, and I've been involved in local planning commissions. I believe that this is a process that we need to give much greater emphasis on how to engage communities earlier in the process to have a real discussion. I think we need at the state level to really map where the potential resources for solar and wind and hydro and everything else are, engage the regional planning commissions at helping to evaluate where we can site well either a solar or wind, and then offer, as we have in the most recent siting bill, substantial deference to communities in the public service board process. So I want us to move to engaging the public, getting communities to plan for where and how and where they do and don't want to site facilities, and really improve the public service process. But let's be clear. A veto power is not going to work if we need to move forward. And that's why Bill McKibben has, in fact, changed his decision and come to endorse me as his candidate for governor. It's why I received the endorsement of environmentalists yesterday from the conservation voters of Vermont. And it's why I think we need to continue to grow our renewable energy and efficiency economy. And let's remember, this is business. This is economic development. These are real high-paying jobs in Vermont. We have one out of 17 Vermonters engaged in the renewable energy and efficiency economy. If we want to have young people move to Vermont, if we want to get Vermont growing, we need to continue our growth of our renewable energy sector. And that's what I want to support as governor.
Is the PSB broken?
I think the PSB, and one of the most important things that I will do as governor very early in my tenure, is appoint a new chair of the Public Service Board. I want that chair to be thinking about and to understand how communities in Vermont work and have a process that engages, perhaps through the public hearing officer, more conversation and planning, but discussion at the local level where they can have access in advance of what you know is a quasi-judicial process that is very difficult for community members to access.
Let's turn to the issue of gun control, because according to a Vermont Digger article, you said that gun control is your top priority. Is it more a priority than the economy and jobs?
I have said all along that my priority is the economy, growing economic opportunity and jobs, livable wage jobs. That's why I have rolled out an economic development program around two key programs, Invest Vermont and Innovate Vermont. I want to invest in our infrastructure and create more livable communities with good-paying jobs, opportunities for entrepreneurs. Like we did in Barrie, $19 million in public investment has led to over $45 million in private investment, 350 new jobs, 27 new businesses, a growing manufacturing, commercial, residential, and retail sector. That's what I want to do across Vermont. That is my top priority. What I want to say about the VT Digger article was, frankly, they first reported it. There was an interview with all of the reporters. The question I was asked was, what would have I done differently had I been governor in the last session? And I raised the topic of gun safety as something that would have been on my priority list that had not been on the priority list of the governor. You know, when they first brought out their headlines, we did call them up, and to their credit, they did change the headline. So I want to thank them for that, but to recognize and underscore for me, as I said in every interview, it is priority number one is economic opportunity for the future.
Let's talk about gun control in more specifics. What is your position in terms of what would you do as governor in the area of gun control?
Well, I'm focused on gun safety, specifically background checks for all gun sales. You know, I certainly respect the Second Amendment, the rights of law-abiding citizens to own guns. I honor our hunting heritage. In fact, I want to increase more young people and women in the hunting and sportsman's community. But I know that we do have a challenge. And for me, frankly, it's often a problem behind closed doors. I've traveled all around this state talking to so many people, whether it's business leaders, healthcare providers, teachers, but also social workers and those who work to prevent domestic violence and victims of domestic violence. And we have a high rate of domestic violence in Vermont. The majority of homicides in Vermont are domestic violence related, and most of them are with a firearm. And what I know is that in states where there are background checks on all handgun sales, there is 40% fewer women shot to death by their intimate partners. We have a significant decrease in suicides from guns and a significant decrease in the number of police officers killed by firearms that were not their own. So I'm not trying to radically change things. Majority of Vermonters currently purchase guns at federally licensed gun dealers. We are where they have a background check, and I would like to extend that to all gun sales, something I consider common sense.
According to this article, you support the ban of assault weapons as well. Is that correct in this article?
Yes, that's correct.
Let me ask you this. There was a ban on, and these assault-type weapons are knockoffs from military weapons. They aren't fully automatic. They're semi-automatic. But nonetheless, they do kill. according to studies, and we banned these knockoff assault-looking rifles for 10 years, there was no sort of decline in violence, gun violence, over a 10-year period. So what does banning assault rifles do?
Well, I think what we can see is that those are the rifles of mass shootings that have happened this year. I mean, what a year it's been, Mike. You know, just 2 weeks before I decided to run, there was a shooting in a church in Charleston. And then 2 months later, a shooting in a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado. And that very same week was San Bernardino, and then we've had Orlando. And so many of these involved these weapons. So I think it's time to take a look at whether they belong in Vermont.
The church in Charleston was a pistol that was used. It was a 9mm or 45mm. I can't remember, or 45 caliber. I can't remember the type of pistol. But you're not talking about banning pistols, are you?
No, I'm not, Mike. I'm just trying to say we have an epidemic of gun violence that's serious, and that when I know that background checks have the ability to actually save lives, that's something I think is common sense. Not trying to take guns away from law-abiding citizens, simply have the same background checked. You know, when I was a soccer coach for 13 years, I had a background check. School bus drivers have background checks. The majority of Vermonters who buy their guns at federally licensed dealers have background checks. I think it's something that should be given to all gun sales.
But in terms of background checks, on the three examples that you cited, and we'll move on from guns after this, but on the three examples you cited, background checks, including expanded background checks, wouldn't have prevented these tragedies.
What I know is that background checks in states that have background checks on all gun sales, 40% fewer women shot to death by their intimate partners, nearly 50% fewer suicides with guns, nearly 50% fewer policemen shot by firearms that were not their own. That's efficacious law that I believe suggests we should move in that direction. And I know that many Vermonters support me in this. I know it's a difficult conversation, and it's a conversation that we will have with respect for one another's differences of opinions. We'll dig into all the questions you're raising. But I think it's time to have the discussion, and I plan to lead on that issue.
One more question on gun control, and then we'll move on. And we'll take a break and then move on to other issues. Isn't the only way to reduce gun violence for certain? There's twofold. It's a twofold way of doing it. One is to get rid of all guns, and two is to attack the underlying issues that result in gun deaths, whether it's mental health, poverty, discrimination, terrorism. What would be your position on that?
I think we have to do all of the above. I think there are so many challenges in our society, and that's actually why I have put forward the programs I've had, whether it's creating economic opportunity, whether it's getting 2 years tuition-free college for young Vermonters so that they have actually access to the skills and qualifications for livable wage jobs so we can have economic security and break the cycle of poverty. We need to be addressing all of our challenges. And if we know that background checks work in states, that we actually have a reduction in the incidence of women being shot to death by their partners, if we know there's a reduction in suicides and death to police officers, I think that's a very important issue to explore.
I want to make sure you heard the question right, because I'm not sure you're going to agree with me with all the question that I asked. I said, in order to reduce gun violence for certain, there's twofold. There's a certain way of doing this that will have a major result. One is to get rid of all guns, and number two is to go after those underlying issues, mental health, poverty, discrimination, terrorism. You said you agreed with me.
Thank you for clarifying. I do not have any intention or desire to take guns away from law-abiding citizens. I respect and honor the rights of gun owners. This is very important to me and to Vermonters. I want to clarify that. It is a lot about the underlying issues, and those are the issues that I'm trying to address as governor.
Sue, I thought we were going to make news there for a minute. We're speaking with Sue Mentor, Democratic candidate for governor. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. When we come back, we're going to be off gun control. We'll be talking about other issues. Give us a call with your questions, comments, or concerns. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Sue Mentor, Democratic candidate for governor. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone line and Sharon in Burlington. Sharon, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hey, Mike. Hey, Sue. I just want to take a moment and thank Sue for really taking the lead on the issue of gun violence, and particularly of how it's linked to domestic violence. I think that when people tout these statistics that Vermont is the safest state in the nation, they're really not looking at where our gun violence lies. We actually rank eighth in the nation in terms of domestic violence, and what being one of the worst states for women in terms of domestic violence. And I really want to applaud Sue for bringing that issue out into the open where it belongs. I think that too often people just look at our flat murder rate, which, yes, it's low, but per capita violence against women is actually very high in this state, and guns figure prominently into that. So I really have to say thank you for shedding light on that issue, because too often it stays in the dark.
Thanks, Sharon, for your phone calls. Sounds like you got a fan.
Well, I think that people involved in the domestic violence network and really see this as a critical issue, and it's interesting to note that I have read that many of the major violence national murders that we have heard about actually have a beginning in domestic violence and or a relationship with that. So thank you, Sharon, for your support and for raising that issue. It is definitely not always talked about, and it is something we need to continue to work on and address, and I will.
What I'm going to try to do, Tom, is speed this up a little bit because we're starting to run out of time, and I got a lot of questions I want to ask here. Let's go to Will in Chittenden. Will, you're on Open Mic. Good morning. Will, if you could make it fast, I'd appreciate it.
I will do that. I will do that. Thank you for having me. I'd also like to commend Ms. Mentor on her feelings on gun safety. I'm intrigued by her comparison with gun safety universal background checks with public sector background checks, which are ubiquitous in this state, in fact, in the country at this point, for almost all positions. And I see that as being quite comparable and a good argument to make when people resist that effort. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Will.
Thank you, Will.
Let's go to Rich in Huntington. Rich, you're on Open Mic.
Good morning, Mike and Sue. As long as we were earlier highlighting honesty and forthrightness, I wonder if in your proposal for universal background checks, you would be willing to level with Vermonters about the fact that in order to enforce universal background checks, it would require a state-run database of all purchases, which could be referred back to make sure that a gun in somebody's possession was, after the date of this enacted law that you propose, have been done according to using the national background check system. So I just want to hear you admit that we are, in order to make this happen, we would need to have a state-run database of all purchases, which would essentially create a gun registration system.
Well, I don't believe it will be a gun registration system, but I do recognize that implementation will take greater engagement from all sectors, and we'll be prepared to work on that as we unroll this program.
Let's switch to some other subjects here. I'm going to try to make them yes and no questions, but I understand you'll have to sort of expand on them. There's a proposal, there's a study going on right now to purchase the Connecticut River dams, the hydro dams on the Connecticut River.
Are you for purchasing those dams? The price tag is about $1 billion.
I really am a supporter of hydro and microhydro, but the purchase of those dams is something I want to understand all of the expenses and potential outcomes. You know, and especially what it's going to mean to ratepayers, as well as sort of the property tax impacts of those local host communities. So there's a whole balance sheet that I need to understand better before I make a decision on whether we should move forward. I think it could also be an opportunity for a partnership of some point.
Let's sort of step back on healthcare. And let's say you could wave a magic wand and design the healthcare system that you want to design.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have any restrictions. The only restriction is that it's got to be have access, affordability, and quality. What would it look like?
Yep. It's what I'm interested in is trying to address the rising cost of healthcare. And I think that really is the thing that is crippling our family budgets, our school budgets and driving property taxes, and our state budget. And when we can actually redesign a system of payment to reward health delivery at its lowest cost in the home and community-based care, to prevent focus on hospital-driven repayments, that's when I think we can actually focus on public health and outcomes. Right now, Mike, we have incentives based on how many visits, how fast people can get in and out of the doctor's office, procedures, and pills. If you think about it, a hospital, to meet its budget, it has to have all of its beds filled, when in fact we want to keep people out of the hospital. So if we could drive support for and repayment for people keeping out of the hospital, keeping people healthy, getting primary and preventive care, getting mental health services at the community level, making sure seniors have access to health care where they live in place, making sure more kids have access to oral health. I'd like to see dentist chairs in schools.
But let me just – that those are components of a system. What does the system look like? How is it paid? Who controls the system? Those sort of things. I'm trying to get what the vision is here in terms of healthcare. Is it public financed healthcare? Is it single payer? Is it a combination of both? That's what I'm trying to get at here with this question.
I think you talked about a system. And that's exactly what we need. We do not have a system of care, and that's the direction that the Green Mountain Care Board has started to go in. When we actually look at all of healthcare delivery as a whole, and not simply how we are paying. Right now, everything is a system of payment and rewards, as opposed to a system of care delivery. An integrated system of care. So I would envision someone being able to get care when they need it and where they need it most. I would envision a system where mental health is on parity with physical health. I would envision a system where everyone has access to a doctor, especially to at their earliest age. I would have a system where we are focused on prenatal and postnatal care. It's where can we actually give health provision at the community and home-based system where we actually are keeping people away from disease and unhealthy behaviors? It's a whole integrated system of care. That's my vision for the future.
Well, let me ask it this way. Who pays for this system?
So the payment reform goes right along with the different system of care. If we have one waiver, the all-payer waiver system, and we are not actually having to pay every single visit, but in fact for an overall system with a budget that we stay within, we will be actually transforming and reducing the cost of health care. That's the goal, Mike, to actually create a system and not have every procedure, every visit paid for. Let me give you an example. I was visiting Middlebury and at the Addison designated agency there. They have started a pilot where they have instead of paying for every visit, they actually have an overall budget. What they have discovered is that they are reducing costs of delivering the care by delivering it where they need it, and not just every single payment being paid for. They are reducing costs, and they're finding better outcomes. That's my vision for the future.
Let me try this one other way. Peter Galbraith was in yesterday, and he talked about the fact that we got to go to a government-run single-payer system. Do you believe in a government-run single-payer system?
I definitely believe that health care is a right. I believe we need to continue to advance our health care reform system. I believe in getting to a program where we are all in and all covered and all paying for it. Yes.
I'm not sure. I'm sorry to harp on this. I'm not sure I understand what that means, we all pay for it. What does that mean?
If we are all, we can look.
Does that mean that we fund it through an income tax, a payroll tax, something like that?
Okay. So right now I'm looking to reform the system. You asked me for the vision of the system. The last thing I will say is before we look at how we pay for it, we reform the system. When we start looking at who's paying how, I believe we need to begin an incremental approach to going back to the single-payer system, which ultimately is the goal. But how do we do it incrementally? I know that both of my Democratic opponents are looking at a primary health universal payment system. I'm also interested in looking at the expansion of Dr. Dinosaur. It's a program that we know how to administer, getting all kids insured up to age 26. That could be a great incentive for more young people moving to Vermont. I think there's great merit to both of those programs. But before I advance on those programs, I want to see their cost and how they would be paid for.
Bob, I've got about 30 seconds. Bob from Plainfield, you're on with Sue Minter.
Good morning. First of all, I think it's going to be a pretty tough sell for any Vermont politician, given our experience with Vermont Health Connect, to convince people you're going to save them anything. But anyway, the question is, do you favor a carbon tax?
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for that question, Bob. I am looking to a regional approach to reducing our carbon emissions. I have developed a plan, an energy and climate action plan, that actually expands upon work I've been doing for the last 3 years as Secretary of Transportation, working with leaders along the Northeast, from Maryland to Maine, to build upon what is currently the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. That is what they call a cap and trade program, where Vermont, it was established under Governor Douglas. We've actually reduced by 24% the amount of carbon emissions, and Vermont has received over $10 million of proceeds to go into renewable energy. That's been focused on the electric sector. What I want to do is move that regional approach to expand it to include transportation, because right now in Vermont, 46% of our carbon footprint is actually from the transportation sector. If we can move regionally to include transportation fuels into our CAP and INVEST program, I believe we will do a lot to both reduce carbon emissions, to help reduce costs for Vermonters, and invest in programs that help people get out of their cars, public transit, sidewalks, car shares, the train that I want to bring back to Montreal, and the train that I want to get to the Amtrak from Rutland to Burlington. That's the goal.
So let me ask you this. The question was, do you believe that we need to have a carbon tax? Is that a yes or no?
That is a no. I'm not supporting a carbon tax. I am looking to a regional approach to how we address our carbon footprint.
Why should people vote for you in the Democratic Party, Democratic primary next Tuesday? I'm giving you 1 minute to tell everybody why they should vote for you.
Well, you know, I've really been working here in Vermont in the trenches through some of our toughest times, Mike. I was a legislator during the Great Recession. I was the Irene recovery officer after the worst natural disaster in nearly a century. I ran the transportation agency. I worked with the Obama White House to curb climate change. And, you know, I'm a mom who has helped my two kids through public school. I've certainly worried about, like many families, college tuition bills. And I want people to vote for me for governor to help Vermont kids get 2 years tuition-free college at community college, to make sure we do pass common sense gun safety, to help address climate change. You know, I'm a candidate people can count on, and I appreciate their vote.
Thank you, Sue Minter. Sue Minter, Democratic candidate for governor. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here, Mike. Thank you.
This is Open Mike, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. On the line is Justin Duckham from Talk Media News. Justin, good morning. How are you? Justin? Well, we seem to have lost.
Hey, sorry. Doing pretty well. Great to be here. How are you?
Great. Thank you. You had me panicked there for a minute that I was...
I apologize. I had my phone on mute by accident, but I'm here now and doing pretty well.
Trump says he's not going to support, as of yet, McCain. Paul Ryan calls Ayotte in New Hampshire, Senator Ayotte, weak. Where's he going?
You know, that's a good question, and that's something that has puzzled a lot of leaders of the Republican Party. Reince Priebus is apparently furious behind closed doors and has been making a number of staff-level calls to try to discern this. Basically, what we're seeing is we're seeing Donald Trump mimic the language that was used by Paul Ryan when he was reluctant to initially endorse him, saying, I'm not ready yet, I'm not there yet, something that Paul Ryan said back when he was mulling his initial endorsement. And this is something that's, you know, pretty interesting. You know, the day before, we actually saw Trump thanking Paul Nelhan, who is challenging Paul Ryan for his, you know, congressional seat in a race that's going to be taking place in a matter of days. You know, he embraced him for, you know, speaking kindly of him. Nelhan responded saying, thank you, sir, just want to make America great again. And it was sort of a signal that, you know, there is not going to be much of an endorsement coming Paul Ryan's way. On the Paul Ryan side of things, he has released a statement saying that they did not ask Donald Trump for his endorsement, nor are they necessarily banking on one, saying that they expect to be, you know, victorious either way. So right now, this is actually kind of a test of Trump's capital to see if these individuals can, you know, withstand a lack of an endorsement, something that they're pretty confident they're going to be able to weather, and something that could actually end up, you know, robbing him of some capital down the road. You know, this is a sort of idea that you do not really give an endorsement if you're a presidential candidate unless you are absolutely sure it's going to, you know, be in your benefit. So this is just the latest sign that this is a very strange campaign, to say the least.
Now, there's history between Ryan and McCain and Trump, both of them against Trump on this. I understand that, and not that I am promoting this sort of behavior, because ultimately, if he's successful, what happens is you lose control of the Senate. But I was really surprised about Kelly Ayotte. And she's in a tough race in New Hampshire. And for him to go after her, that may actually tip the scales against her in New Hampshire. And why would you ever do that and have a Democrat win the election over a Republican when you're the standard bearer for the Republican Party?
You know, that's a good question. And as much as I hesitate to play armchair psychologist, this is basically further evidence that this is the Trump campaign and just that, that this is about Trump himself generally. And basically, he feels like he has a chip on the shoulder and therefore needs to push back against those who may have been reluctant for him. Kelly Ayotte in particular is surprising. You know, she doesn't necessarily be a very vocal critic of him. She did say that she is going to side with military families no matter what in a pretty muted statement. She did not attend the Republican convention a little while back. And this is, you know, something where Trump can actually cause real damage. As you mentioned, this is a very close race. It's also a state that's a swing state, and that could be, you know, pretty perilous as well. And it's a state that Trump actually has some pretty, you know, heavy command in. This was the first state that he won of the, you know, election cycle. He won it by a pretty stunning amount, absolutely decimating Jeb Bush, who was considered to be, you know, a pretty big favorite there. coming ahead of Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. And this is a state where it's shown that people actually listen to him, and the state that he has had a long history in. Back when he was initially mulling a presidential run in the 80s, he started off in New Hampshire and has been making the rounds there for years. So these are people who know Trump, people who will listen to Trump, and this should be pretty shocking for anybody who is looking to maintain control of the Senate.
And that's the whole thing. I mean, Trump himself has said that he'll go it alone if he has to, if the Republicans lose the Senate. My question is this. So why would Republicans be loyal to him if he's not loyal to them?
That's a good question. And I think right now there's just this sort of concern that if you suddenly decide to, withdraw your support just because he's not supporting you, you're put in a situation where, the easy question comes up of, this is the final straw. And it really just looks like it's basically just self-interest at its worst. You've had these individuals staying quiet when he's gone after a good number of Americans, and he's made, attacks against the judge and whatnot. And to have this suddenly be the final straw would just be a little bit, hypocritical. But I think this really just raises some serious concerns with those who are running. I think they're obviously in a very delicate position. They have been trying to do a fine line where they embrace Trump while not fully embracing Trump in public, considering that they are in states that's a little uneasy with this candidacy, in particular with John McCain. And it's just not good for anybody, and it's certainly fueling a lot of talk that there could be some major shakeups before Election Day.
Before we move on, we only got a few minutes. I got to ask this question: is he trying to lose the election?
That's a good question. At this point, I don't think that's what it looks like. I think if he was not actually interested in it, we would see a much greater elevation of, Mike Pence beforehand. I think we would see Trump, operating in a different way. But this does raise some serious concerns over whether or not he's going to make it to Election Day, and will ultimately put Trump in a pretty good position wherein he will play the role that he feels most comfortable as, which would be to essentially be the kingmaker, to give his support to one of the other candidates out there before the RNC's 168 members come out and order that final vote. So I think if he wants to get out there, he has a pretty good exit plan. He's already been laying the groundwork, saying that no matter what, the election's going to be rigged. He's already cited a number of grievances against him. And I think at this point, he could probably make an argument that, this has become a race that he just isn't going to win due to some scary forces working behind the scenes and whatnot, and give it to a candidate who's probably more palatable to the party and the country at large.
So Hillary Clinton's strategy is to sit back and watch Donald Trump, because he seems to be imploding at least this week.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. If we look at exactly what the Democrats probably really would have hoped for after the convention, this is shaping up to be probably their ideal scenario. We have Hillary Clinton with a 4-point bounce, leading Trump by 7 or 8 points in most polls that we've seen after the convention. And all of the spotlight on him as, the chatter rises about his campaign imploding. They did not necessarily put out a script in order for him to, go after Gold Star families, or to try to shift the debates around, or to claim that he got a letter from the NFL that just does not seem to exist. While she could just kind of sit this out, she is making inroads in, states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and North Carolina, and going out there and trying to, essentially bring the message home. But it's sort of a bonus for her, the fact that there is the GOP candidate who is really just shooting himself in the foot continually through no guidance of her own.
We don't have time to get to international issues. I wanted to get to Iran, but let's stay with domestic and let's stay with political. The DNC fired people yesterday. This is the fallout from the email controversy, right, Justin?
Exactly. This is Donna Brazile, who is a former DNC chair, better known from the CNN fame, who came in and promised to shake up. And this is exactly what we are seeing right now. We saw three DNC top officials fired or leaving, including the CEO. We know that Debbie Wasserman Schultz is, obviously on her, way out, has essentially already stepped down at this point with the new person coming in. And there's a lot of, concern right now over who Hillary Clinton, if she, becomes president, or who the president himself could choose for a permanent replacement. There's some rumblings that it could be a, more progressive face for the DNC to accurately reflect how the party has kind of shifted in recent years. We see a lot of rumblings about perhaps Elizabeth Warren, which would make sense. She's a prolific fundraiser. She's somebody who is the face of the modern-day Democratic Party, has respect both in Hillary world and Bernie world, and could probably, chair that pretty effectively. So all bets are off right now. A lot of people are watching to see what happens next, but this is certainly, all in response to the DNC email scandal that we saw really kind of take away a lot of momentum from the convention and, put a lot of doubts in on the organization of the party structure.
Justin, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you. You have a good one.
Same to you. Justin Duckham, Talk Media News. Up next, Elizabeth Hewitt, reporter for Vermont Digger, and we're going to be talking about a court case in Bennington County that was a very interesting case dealing with revenge porn. And we'll be asking Elizabeth what that means, revenge porn, in just a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in our WDEV studios Elizabeth Hewitt, reporter for Vermont Digger. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Mike.
One of the topics, one of the articles that you wrote that caught my eye at Vermont Digger was the article on revenge porn. Can you explain what is revenge porn?
Sure. So revenge porn is, this is something that's been a topic of discussion not only in Vermont but across the country, and it's really something that has come about as in tandem with the expansion of social media and technology and that kind of thing. And so the idea, the concept that is often put forward is that you have a couple that while together might share intimate photographs of themselves by text or social media. And they, once, you know, when they break up, that one partner might post some of those images online of their ex in a way just to get back at them. And so you hear these sort of scenarios put out from time to time of somebody posted on their Facebook page as a way of shaming them. They might try to, you know, post it on their ex-partner's work Facebook page as trying to ruin their reputation. And so this is an issue that has been really attracting lawmakers and just sort of civic attention across the country.
And the legislature did do something. About a year ago, mm-hmm. they passed a law that, I'm going to ask you, what did the law do in terms of revenge porn?
Right. So this was a bill. It started in the House, and it's this law that criminalizes posting images of your ex-partner in this manipulative way, but with a fine of it can come with a fine of up to $2,000 and can come with a penalty of up to 2 years in prison. So it establishes pretty steep penalties for this particular act. Now, it's worth mentioning that as it worked its way through the legislature, I think in the end won quite a fair bit of support when it actually came to the floor votes in the end. But in the committee rooms, there was a lot of grappling between victims' rights advocates who said that this is something that is a really serious issue. This ruins people's lives, especially women. That this is seen as really targeting women, especially. And so they said that there's a real need to do something about this. On the other end of the spectrum, you had the civil liberties advocates, the ACLU, the Defender General's Office, who really raised a lot of concerns as this was working its way through the legislature that this would have pretty serious implications for First Amendment rights.
And in the end, as you said, it passed fairly overwhelmingly. So the victim aspect of this was persuasive to the legislature.
I mean, this is and when that passed, I think that this is actually part of a broader, though this is a very specific instance of technology and society, this is part of a broader trend that lawmakers are really grappling with how to keep Vermont statutes up in line with modern technology, right? That things change so fast with the internet that I think this is part of that effort to try to keep Vermont's laws in line with that.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Hewitt, a reporter for Vermont Digger. We're talking about revenge porn, and we'll be talking about a particular court case in Bennington County in just a moment. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Turning to Bennington County, There was a court case. Can you set this court case up for us?
Sure. So the law was enacted last year, last July 1st, I believe, and so it went into effect then. And as far as many people seem to know, this case down in Bennington County is the first time that any charges were brought under this new statute. So what happened, it actually involved three individuals. So one woman who got a text actually saying that somebody had posted photographs of her on Facebook. And so she logged onto her Facebook and she saw that a man who she had used to message with had posted images that she had sent to him willingly of herself, and that now those images were posted on his public Facebook page. So she was distraught at it, and she was trying to figure out what was going on. And it turned out, allegedly, that that another woman who was also involved, or who was involved with this man, had logged on to his
Facebook.
We're going
to have to do a graph here.
I know. It's a complicated relationship. But so another woman had logged on to this man's Facebook account through a phone and had found these images and had posted them on his page. So the charges are not against the man. They're against this woman that had logged on to post these images. And so that case happened back, the incident happened back in October. The Bennington County's state's attorney's office brought the charges, I think, at the end of November. And so this has been kind of working its way through the court. Now, the defendant, the woman, she, her attorney filed a motion to dismiss back in February. And he, in his motion, argued that this law, as applied in this case, is a violation of her constitutional rights. And ultimately, in a decision that the judge handed down on July 1st, he agreed.
And what was some of the logic that the judge was using in saying this is a First Amendment issue?
So this is he brought up, trying to think back to the, it's a 5-page decision, and it's a pretty complex legal, for a non-lawyer, I'm trying to keep track of all of the details in my head, but he raised, one of the points that came up was that there's a very limited number of things that that can be, number of types of speech that can be legally restricted, and you have to really fit into a certain, into these certain cookie cutters, and one of them is obscenity. It's generally, according to the judge's decision, it's generally agreed that nudity in itself does not constitute obscenity. And so he floated that, you know, there could possibly be this argument to make that something could, that revenge porn could be obscene because of the intention behind it. But that he noted that there's no basis for that, really, at this point. So he couldn't go in that direction. And there was a discussion of some other aspects of how this fits. One of the things that he raised actually was that this case shows, I mean, just because it is those three people as the third party that's involved here, it's not your typical, or what is outlined in the news media often as, a typical revenge porn case with two people. And so this really opens up the possibilities. He says, you know, this could be, it, under what this case shows is that if, say, like a wife found a husband's, like, went onto a husband's phone and found images that he had not asked for, and in disgust shared them with her friend to, you know, freak out about it or something, that it seems that could be criminal underneath this law. And so ultimately he ruled to dismiss the case. Now, within pretty short order of that, the Attorney General's office, who had been monitoring this case all along, as it's pretty notable because it was such an early application of the law, they have gotten involved, and along with the Bennington County State's Attorney's Office, have filed papers in the Supreme Court to try to appeal this. And it's not a typical appeal because it's a misdemeanor, and so it has to be, they have to file for a petition of extraordinary relief, I think. So it's not quite a typical appeal, but it seems likely that the Supreme Court will hear this case.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Hewitt, reporter for Vermont Digger, and the topic is revenge porn. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about the ramifications of this decision.
Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with us is Elizabeth Hewitt, reporter for Vermont Digger. And the topic that we're talking about is revenge porn. One of the things, Elizabeth, that I'd like you to do, if you could, because we're talking about a Bennington court case where the judge ruled in this particular case, if you were listening in the last 15 minutes, where the judge ruled that there are some First Amendment issues here and that he ruled against a person who was alleging that she was revenge porned, I guess, is the word. But one of the things before we start, if people are just dialing in, can you just explain what revenge porn is one more time?
Oh, sure. So it's this sort of new phenomenon, relatively new, I guess, wherein two members of a couple might share intimate photographs of themselves via text or social media while they're together, and then once they break up, one member of the couple might post those images in a public online forum in with the intention of sort of ruining the other person, of ruining the reputation and sort of getting revenge on them.
And then in this case in Bennington County, it's a little bit complicated, right. And I want to make sure that people understand. The photos were sent by a woman to a man,
right.
But the photos that ended up on social media were from the man's phone or social media device, but it was sent by another woman who was involved with the man.
Right. So it was the first woman, the woman who was who's the accusing witness here, she had voluntarily sent some images of herself to a man over Facebook private message. And at a later date, those were still on his Facebook account. At a later date, a second woman, accessed that man's private account and found the images, and she basically decided to seek revenge on this woman, the first woman, by posting those images publicly. And these are, I mean, it's a pending court case. These are allegations. The affidavit does get into that the second woman, who is the one that was charged with this crime, did say to a trooper that she had posted these images.
And what this case ended up to be was a First Amendment versus sort of a victim issue here, and the judge sort of came down on the First Amendment side.
Right. And this is something that this is not an old law at all. This is the first time it's being used, and so this is actually tapping into a concern that civil liberties advocates had all along through the lawmaking process, was that this could be infringing too much on First Amendment rights, which of course are very well protected, and it's something that has come up again and again in court cases through the centuries. And so it's kind of getting back to this age-old question of what can be limited by law when it comes to free speech.
And the state's attorney and the attorney general have decided to appeal this to mm-hmm. the Vermont Supreme Court. What if this stands? What are the ramifications of this decision?
If the Supreme Court rules along with the Bennington County judge, I spoke with actually Representative Keisha Rahm, who was one of the movers and shakers behind this legislation when it went through last year. And she, when I chatted with her about it, she really said that this is an important issue. That if you know that she used the phrase gray area, recognizing that this is a really hard line to walk between privacy rights and the rights that somebody has over the images of their body and First Amendment rights. And she said, you know, like if this gets overturned, that she sees a real need to go back. And this is a big enough problem that she thinks that lawmakers should go back and try again.
Are there any other challenges in any other states? There's 34 other states that have revenge porn laws. Is there any other challenges out there, or do you know of any?
So I'm not sure of any specific instances, but I do know that these are handled in different ways in different states. So those 34 states did not all take the same approach that we did. And so I actually heard from an attorney who's working on a case in Arizona. So, you know, there are challenges definitely going on in different parts of the country. It's such a major issue. And just to go back to that, I want to get back to that the tension between these civil liberties advocates and the victims' rights advocates, because civil, you know, if you, I spoke with the ACLU, for instance, or Defender General Matt Valerio, and they don't say that, oh, revenge porn isn't a problem. And it's not that they belittle it at all. They just say that there are other remedies in place that are shy of criminal action where these cases can play out. And so there is, you know, there's a civil, you could take this to civil court and battle it out there, where the penalties would be monetary likely. And so there are other ways of dealing with it that are less, less strict than a criminal penalty.
One of the things that you just said that sort of raised my interest, other states do it differently. How do they do it differently?
So you're testing my knowledge of revenge porn laws. There certainly are stricter and less strict interpretations of how to go about this. I think that sort of different states are sort of figuring out how to do it themselves. But I'm not familiar with the specifics of any other law.
Let's turn to something that's a little bit easier. Let's turn to politics. Yesterday you wrote a story about Senator Bernie Sanders, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, endorsing David Zuckerman, who's running for lieutenant governor. Why did Sanders do it?
Well, Sanders and Zuckerman have they've known each other for a long time. When I spoke with Zuckerman yesterday, he recalled that he first became involved in a Bernie Sanders campaign back in 1992, I think he said, when Sanders was running for Congress. And he described himself as sort of disillusioned with the political system as a college student. And then he sees this candidate, Bernie Sanders, who absolutely lit up his interest and his passion. And so Zuckerman has been in the House. He was in the House for several terms, and I believe worked a bit with Sanders at that time. And then he switched to the Senate. He was elected to the Senate in 2012. And he has been pretty strong in sort of invoking Sanders' name throughout the campaign so far. Of course, it's a very tight Democratic race there for that LG nomination with Representative Keisha Rahm and House Speaker Shep Smith also in. When I spoke with Zuckerman, he did say, you know, he thinks that their priorities are his priorities are in line with Sanders, with what Sanders brought to the presidential campaign. It still does sort of remain to be seen. Listeners might recall that back in May, Representative Chris Pearson up in Burlington, who is running for a Chittenden County Senate seat, was highlighted in a Sanders campaign email as a local race to take an interest in. And Pearson raised something like $60,000 in the aftermath of that email blast, and it was really a huge boost to him. It is unclear, when I spoke with Zuckerman, he said it's unclear if Sanders plans to use his massive email network to throw his weight behind Zuckerman in that way. Sanders got 86% of the vote in the Democratic presidential primary, so it could be a boon for him.
So does Zuckerman think it's going to make a difference here?
He was pretty excited about it when I talked to him yesterday, and he did say, you know, they'll be sending it out, making sure that people know that Sanders' name is behind him now.
Elizabeth Hewitt, reporter for Vermont Digger, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Mike.
Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I want to take a few minutes to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. Phil Scott and Bruce Lissman, Republican candidates for governor, will be on Open Mic tomorrow. And also, you heard today from Sue Minter, that's the last of the Democratic candidates that will be on this program this week. We spoke with Matt Dunn and Peter Galbraith yesterday, Sue Minter today, and the Republicans tomorrow, Phil Scott and Bruce Lissman. We've got a few minutes, so I'd like to sort of return to the subject that lit up the phone lines in the beginning of the program. Didn't have a lot of time to get to all your calls, but it certainly left a lot of people hanging there on the phone lines, and I want to make sure that you get a chance to call in. We've got about 10 minutes left, so give us a call. And it was Donald Trump. And the question is he trying to lose the election? Because in my estimation, he's doing a good job if that is his motivation right now. And it's not only that.
It's time for Republicans to speak up. We spoke about this earlier with Justin Duckham from Talk Media News. Trump isn't loyal to Republicans. Why he went after Kelly Ayotte when she's in a close race in New Hampshire baffles the mind. And one of the discussions we had, this is a Trump campaign. It's not a Republican campaign. So Trump isn't loyal to Republicans. And why should Republicans be loyal to him? He won't endorse Republicans. He rails against the leadership in the Republican Party. And maybe he has some points. But he's running as a Republican. If you don't like it, then don't run as a Republican. If you don't believe in the Republican Party, then don't run in the Republican Party. You certainly have enough money that you can run as an independent. So why are you trying to drag the whole party down with you? And for conservatives, he doesn't espouse conservative views. He talks about raising taxes, forcing Apple to come back from China to locate in the United States. That's not going to bring any jobs. Apple will figure out how to automate if he forces them to do that. First of all, I don't think he's in the presidential power in order to do that. And he's not a fair trade guy. So why do conservatives feel that they have to support him? They don't. And they don't. They don't trust him. And we talked about military, active duty military personnel and veterans. Look, they are looking for somebody new. They are looking for a leader. And they're frustrated. I get that. But is this the guy? He hasn't served in the military, and I get it. You don't need to serve in the military to be the commander-in-chief. I'm not saying you do. But he did everything he could to make sure that he didn't serve in the military, and that's including 5 deferments. But you just don't do the things that he's been doing. You don't call out the parents of a dead soldier. And I don't care how much they criticize you. And we talked about this earlier. Hillary Clinton didn't do that when Patricia Smith went after her with the death of her son, Sean Smith, in Benghazi. The Purple Heart incident yesterday just baffles me. Because anybody with respect for what a Purple Heart means would not take it. Would simply say, I am honored that you tried to give this to me, but I have not earned it. Instead of saying, I always wanted these, I got it the easy way. I had to shake my head. I had to shake my head when he went after the parents as well of a falling soldier. And I said this, I don't often agree with President Obama. And I know that upsets some of you. But it's time for Republicans to stand up and stop supporting Trump. Look, this election this year, I get people are upset about this, where we are in this country. People feel that the economic and political systems are rigged. They're looking for something different. They're looking for somebody that can shake things up and change things. Why do you think Bernie Sanders had such an impact out there? He was one of those people. Trump is another. But is this the direction we want? Give me a call at 802-244-1777. I got about 7 minutes. Or toll free at 877-291-8255. I understand. And we've talked about this earlier. The recession, the Great Recession of 2008, had an enormous impact on our collective psyche, not only in this state, but in the country. And the crash of 2008 made us distrust politicians, made us distrust business leaders, made us distrust particularly financial leaders. I mean, you look on any sort of Gallup survey, the financial sector, banks in particular, have plummeted in terms of our support, of our positive image of what they are, and it's plummeted since 2008. And I get it.
Everybody is concerned about the future. That somehow the future won't be as good as the past. But is this what you want? Is this the guy, Republicans, that his whole strategy is to insult his way to the presidency? And maybe he wins. What then? What will the party look like, win or lose, when Donald Trump is left with it, is done with it? And that's the question that Republicans have got to deal with. Trump is not loyal to the Republicans. Then why should Republicans be loyal to him? I've made it clear. I'm not going to vote for Trump. The question is, can you give me the reasons why you're going to vote for him? So is Trump trying to lose this election? Give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. It definitely generates controversy. We've got full phone lines again. Maureen from Montpelier. Maureen, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, Mike. I'm a fellow 1971 graduate.
Okay, hey, Maureen, can you turn down? Can you turn down your radio?
I'm a fellow Woodstock Union High School 71 graduate.
Well, hi, Maureen. How are you?
Otherwise known as Gilly.
Yes.
But anyway, I just want to tell you why. What a quote from Hunter S. Thompson. If you're familiar with Hunter,
I am. Despite my time in high school, Maureen, and how bad I was in high school, I do know Hunter Thompson.
You weren't bad. you were a good student. I will say that for you. You were an excellent student.
Maureen,
so anyway.
Maureen, I graduated 98th out of 104.
So anyway, I'm going to tell you why you really shouldn't vote for Trump. And I'm a Democrat, and say no more. But anyway, I found a quote from Hunter S. Thompson about that he wrote about Nixon. And it was so poignant to who Trump is. And here's the quote. And with that, I'll hang up. But he was, meaning Nixon, and who I think now fits Trump, a pungent cocktail of jingoism, vaudeville, and slander.
Interesting, Maureen. And Maureen,
thank you for
calling in. It's great to hear from you.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
That's Maureen from Montpelier. Thank you for your phone call. I don't know what to say, given the fact that she knows me from high school days. But thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Gene and Barry. Gene, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I said all along that Trump was incompetent, and I'm not the only one been saying this. Because if you listen to him, I said, too, that he was an independent, just like Bernie.
Yeah, I mean, he is an independent.
You know,
he was actually, Gene, a Democrat.
Knew this. They said way at the beginning, he's not a conservative. That's why they didn't want him. But you know, Trump tricked them because he made fun of each one of them that run. There was, about 16, 17 of them, Republicans?
16,
and
yep.
He made fun of them and their wives, and he knew they would back out. And he would be left, and they'd have to nominate him, which they said they had to. But he's very cagey, you know, of things, and he's not president material. We can see that he gets mad, and boy, he really flies off the handle. You've seen him on TV, and boy, I said all along he was incompetent anyway. You can tell by listening to him.
Thanks, Gene, for your phone call. I appreciate it. You know, one of the things that Gene makes a good point here is that he isn't a conservative. She's right. He was a Democrat. So, you know, there are suspicions with the conservatives in terms of who he is and what he represents. He doesn't represent the policies
of the Republican Party. You know, one of the things that I wanted to get to, too, is sort of the Republican primary here in this state. Maybe we'll get to it on Friday. I want to talk a little bit about it because I got some strong feelings about the Republican primary here. And as you know, as you, I've gone strongly with Trump, so let's talk about the Republican primary probably on Friday. I want to thank our guest, Sue Minter, Democratic candidate for governor. She was in studio. Also, I want to thank Elizabeth Hewitt, reporter for Vermont Digger, and Justin Duckham from Talk Media News, and of course, all of you. And tomorrow, Phil Scott and Bruce Lissman, Republican candidates for governor, urge you to call in if you have any comments or opinions about either of them. They'll be here. We'll take your phone calls in terms of what's going on. And as I've said in the beginning, as candidates come into this studio and talk about their positions, I get a little tougher and tougher and tougher as we go on. But it is something that I've told every candidate that I'm going to do in terms of challenging their various positions. I think it's important that you hear what their positions are and how they defend their positions. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV, let me go back, 85 years? WDEV News Radio? That's got to be celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pontic.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.